Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 580, titled The Jews of Asia, the Suk Ching Massacres and Their Significance for Today. This has been recorded on January 15th of the year 2007, the Martin Luther King holiday. This program is going to deal with a subject that is at the same time about as far from the endeavors of Martin Luther King and the American civil rights struggle as one could get, and yet it is going to deal with something that is part and parcel to one of the psychosocial, arguably the psychosocial dynamic that is at the core of bigotry against African Americans, because indeed ethnic bigotry, particularly when it becomes institutionalized in a given society, very often is rooted in scapegoating, in blaming other people for problems for which they are not, in fact, responsible. The Chinese have been known as the Jews of Asia. This is due to a couple of things. For one thing, the Chinese have, in particular, the outside or overseas Chinese, ethnic Chinese living outside of China and in some of the other Asian countries, Southeast Asia in particular, Chinese in general and the outside or overseas Chinese in particular, have been very brutally treated. They have been scapegoated for the problems of other ethnic groups, and in some of the Asian countries that have Muslim minorities, they have been scapegoated and demonized in a manner not unlike the way Jews have traditionally been scapegoated and demonized in Christian and also Muslim societies as well. The Chinese, of course, were on the receiving end of some utterly murderous genocidal policy on the part of the Japanese during World War II, certainly during the war proper, including the years of World War II that took place before the United States entered that conflict. When Americans think of World War II, they think of 1941 to 45, but in reality, World War II began in 1931 when the Japanese invaded Manchuria. Then in 1935, Mussolini invaded Ethiopia, and it began in earnest and permanently when the Chinese and Japanese began in the late 1930s, when they opened up that conflict, when the Japanese invaded China and opened up a broad-based conflict that lasted through the end of the war. One of the things that we are going to be looking at in this broadcast in particular is the scapegoating of the overseas or outside Chinese by not only Muslim majority in Malaya, now Malaysia, but in particular how the Japanese utilized the ethnic bigotry against the outside or overseas Chinese in some of the majority Muslim countries in order to solidify their position as occupiers of those countries. In particular, we're going to be taking a look at the country we now call Malaysia, but the country that was called Malaya back in the World War II period. That is a majority Muslim country, but there is a large Chinese minority in that country that is also the cream of the economic elite of that country. The ethnic Chinese, the overseas or outside Chinese in many of the Muslim countries enjoy a superior economic and social status simply because they are more prosperous. And one of the things that the Chinese and the Jews have in common is they are the two oldest continuing literary civilizations on Earth. And literacy has a lot to do with success in the modern world, the industrial world in particular. And the Chinese, being exponents of one of the oldest literate cultures in existence, are generally highly educated. And the overseas or outside Chinese are much better educated and also much more prosperous than their Muslim country persons and fellow citizens. For that reason, traditionally, In many of the majority Muslim countries of Asia, the Chinese have been scapegoated, sometimes with murderous results, by the Muslim majority. And one of the things that we're going to be looking at in this broadcast are the Sukching massacres that took place during World War II. Because indeed, the Sukching massacres and other efforts on the part of the Japanese directed at the Muslim majorities in some of the Muslim countries that they occupied in World War II, they were aided actively by Haji Amin al-Husseini, a Muslim cleric, a man who was a high-ranking officer in the SS who recruited numerous fighting formations for the Third Reich, including several Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions. Haji Amin al-Husseini also was the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement. And just as he worked on behalf of the Germans in World War II, he also did work, although not as much work, on behalf of the Japanese. Not only was he active in propagandizing the Muslim majorities in some of the Muslim majority countries that the Japanese occupied, Malaya and Indonesia being a couple. But he also, that is to say, Haji Amin al-Husseini, was also quite active in doing propaganda broadcasts for the Japanese, directed at the very large Muslim majority in what was at that time the British colony of India. India, recall, at this time included not only what we now call India, but also Pakistan. But because of the brutal ethnic hostility between Hindu and Muslim in India, those two countries eventually separated after they got their independence. But we're going to take a look at the Jews of Asia, and in particular the Sukching massacres, by way of understanding not only how the principle of scapegoating can, or the tactic of scapegoating can be utilized, but in particular with the rising political thermostat in the world as a whole because of militant Islam, and in particular in the United States and Europe with the surge of anti-Semitism, taking a look at the Jews of Asia, the Chinese, and the treatment they have received from fascism and also from Islamic fascist elements associated with the Japanese is worth taking a look at. We're going to begin by reading an article that is, in fact, it's not an article, it's an op-ed column by Paul Krugman, the economic columnist of the New York Times. This was from the New York Times of October 21st of 2003, and it's titled Listening to Mahathir. Now, what Krugman is talking about here was an address that Muhammad Mahathir made to the Malaysian people on roughly the occasion of his stepping down. He'd been prime minister, his term had come to an end, and he gave a long speech, and a chunk of it was about as virulent an anti-Semitic rant as one could possibly find. Sadly, a type of rant that has become relatively common these days. But what is interesting is to see this anti-Semitic screed on the part of an Asian prime minister. And Paul Krugman does a fairly good job of explaining what this was really directed at. The reality is that the anti-Semitic rant, which was only a relatively small part of his speech, was directed, it was, as Paul Krugman puts it, it was political red meat tossed to the Muslim majority in the country of Malaya. And one of the reasons that he did that was to curry favor with the Muslim majority, because in Malaya, the core of the business community and, as a result, the core of the economic revenue-generating section of society is the Chinese minority, the highly educated and very industrious Chinese minority in Malaya, one that, because of its success and because of its literacy, has been scapegoated by the Muslim majority, and also a minority with whom any successful ruler of that part of the world has had to ally him or herself simply because their role in the commercial life of Malaya is pivotal. And when alienated, they can do much to bring things to a halt. So writing of the Muslim majority and Mr. Mahathir's courting of the Muslim majority, and in turn, the economic and political relationship between the Muslim majority and the ethnic Chinese minority, Paul Krugman writes as follows in the New York Times of October 21, 2003, in listening to Mahathir. Quote, "The Europeans killed 6 million Jews out of 12 million, but today the Jews rule this world by proxy. They get others to fight and die for them," unquote. So said Mahathir Mohamad, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, at an Islamic summit meeting last week. The White House promptly denounced his hate-filled remarks, unquote. Indeed, those remarks were inexcusable, but they were also calculated, for Mr. Mahathir is a cagey politician who was neither ignorant nor foolish. And to understand why he made those remarks is to realize how badly things are going for U.S. foreign policy. The fact is that Mr. Mahathir, though guilty of serious abuses of power, is in many ways about as forward-looking a Muslim leader as we're likely to find. And Malaysia is the kind of success story we wish we saw more of: an impressive record of economic growth, rising education levels, and general modernization in a nation with a Muslim majority. It's worth reading the rest of last week's speech beyond the offensive 28 words. Most of it is criticism directed at other Muslims, clerics in particular. Mr. Mahathir castigates, quote, "interpreters of Islam who taught that acquisition of knowledge by Muslims meant only the study of Islamic theology," unquote. Thanks to these interpreters, again quoting from Mahathir's address, the study of science, medicine, etc. was discouraged. Intellectually, the Muslims began to redress, unquote. Intellectually, the Muslims began to regress, unquote. A lot of the speech sounds as if it had been written by Bernard Lewis, author of What Went Wrong, the best-selling book about the Islamic decline. So what's with the anti-Semitism? Almost surely it's part of Mr. Mahathir's domestic balancing act, something I learned about the last time he talked like this during the Asian financial crisis of 1997 and 98. Parenthetically, when that Asian financial crisis took place, Mahathir blamed it basically on Jewish speculators and on Jewish control of the Western economy and the banks, etc. A fairly standard anti-Semitic rant, and one that he reverted to, I'm not sure if reverted was quite the idea, one that he resorted to almost reflexively at that time. But as Paul Krugman explains here, what Mahathir really was doing was courting favor with the Muslim majority, and that basically, that Muslim majority is relatively poor and relatively unsuccessful, and they contrast very sharply with the highly educated, industrious Chinese minority, the overseas or outside Chinese, the Jews of Asia. Continuing with Paul Krugman's column, speaking of the Asian financial crisis of 1997 and 98, Krugman writes, "At that time, rather than accept the austerity programs recommended by the U.S. government and the IMF, Mahathir loudly blamed machinations by Western speculators and imposed temporary controls on the outflow of capital, a step denounced by all but a handful of Western economists. As it turned out, his economic strategy was right. Malaysia suffered a shallower slump and achieved a quicker recovery than its neighbors." What became clear watching Mr. Mahathir back then was that his strident rhetoric was actually part of a delicate balancing act aimed at domestic politics. Malaysia has a Muslim, ethnically Malay majority, but its business drive comes mainly from an ethnic Chinese minority. Parenthetically, that Chinese minority are the outside or overseas Chinese, again, the ones primarily known as the Jews of Asia because of the similarity between the prejudice and extermination of the outside or overseas Chinese and that to which the Jews have been subjected to in other countries. Continuing, speaking of the outside or overseas Chinese minority in Malaysia, to keep the economy growing, Mr. Mahathir must allow the Chinese minority to prosper, but to ward off ethnic tensions, he must throw favors, real and rhetorical, to the Malays. Part of that balancing act involves reserving good jobs for Malay workers and giving special business opportunities to Malay entrepreneurs. One reason Mr. Mahathir was so adamantly against IMF austerity plans was that he feared that they would disrupt the carefully managed cronyism that holds his system together. When times are tough, Mr. Mahathir also throws the Muslim majority rhetorical red meat. And parenthetically, that's what his anti-Semitic rap was about. And that's what he was doing last week. Not long ago, Washington was talking about Malaysia as an important partner in the war on terror. Now, Mr. Mahathir thinks that to cover his domestic flank, he must insert hateful words into a speech mainly about Muslim reform. That tells you more accurately than any poll just how strong the rising tide of anti-Americanism and anti-Semitism among Muslims in Southeast Asia has become. Thanks to its war in Iraq and its unconditional support for Ariel Sharon, Washington has squandered post-9/11 sympathy and brought relations with the Muslim world to a new low. And bear in mind that Mr. Mahathir's remarks were written before the world learned about the views of Lieutenant General William "My God is Bigger Than Yours" Boykin. By making it clear that he sees nothing wrong with giving an important post in the war on terror who someone believes and says openly that Allah is a false idol, General Boykin denies that's what he meant, but his denial was implausible even by current standards. Donald Rumsfeld has gone a long way toward confirming the Muslim world's worst fears. Somewhere in Pakistan, Osama bin Laden must be enjoying this. The war on terror didn't have to be perceived as a war on Islam, but we seem to be doing our best to make it look that way. Well, indeed, there are common evidentiary tributaries between the Islamic fascism of today and Islamic fascist elements who allied with the fascist Japanese in World War II in order to rally the Muslim majorities in some of the Muslim majority countries occupied by the Japanese. And one of the ways that the Japanese catered to the Muslim majority in order to solidify their position as occupiers in World War II was to engage in economic and rhetorical propagandistic persecution of the outside or overseas Chinese, the Jews of Asia. Perhaps the most dramatic and bloody outcropping of the Japanese persecution of the outside Jews in World War II were the Suk Ching massacres. Those were literally massacres against ethnic Chinese that were undertaken first in Malaya and then in other of the Japanese-occupied Muslim-majority nations of Asia in World War II. And this, again, should also be seen, of course, against the background of the Japanese massacres, the enormous Japanese massacres conducted against Chinese in China during World War II, the best known of those, the Rape of Nanking. We're going to read about the Suk Ching massacres and of the murderous Japanese persecution of the outside or overseas Chinese in Malaya, and we're going to rely for our information on the book Gold Warriors, subtitled America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold, that landmark text, authored by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave, was published by Verso Books and copyright 2004. And we're going, actually, but it might be copyright 2003. But anyway, that will all be in the description for the broadcast. We're going to read about the Suk Ching massacres. And in particular, we're going to read about the outside or overseas Chinese reactions against Japanese occupation, their unwillingness to mobilize their economic largesse on behalf of the Japanese, and how the Japanese responded. In Gold Warriors, Peggy and Sterling Seagrave write, "Because most of the stolen treasure reaching Japan made its way into private vaults and the vaults of the imperial family, Tokyo's strategy for the economic exploitation of Southeast Asia was a failure. It was also sabotaged by overseas Chinese who controlled the region's raw materials, industries, agriculture, smuggling, and rackets. While they despised the Japanese for the rape of China, they hated them in particular for bombing Amoy, Swatow, and other harbors along the China coast that were the ancestral homes of their dialect groups. In the past, Western companies had been successful in Southeast Asia only when they found ways to work with the overseas Chinese. as Japan took over and tried to set up equivalent monopolies of oil, sugar, rice, salt, and other commodities, whole sectors of local economies collapsed. Prices shot up, the supply of goods came to a halt, and there was massive unemployment, famine, inflation, and hoarding. In retaliation, overseas Chinese became targets. Experts in terror were sent to punish them. Colonel Watanabe Wataru spent 10 years in North China developing techniques such as kidnapping members of prosperous Chinese families, amputating body parts starting with ears, noses, and fingers, then continuing to breasts and testicles. He was especially effective when he threatened to castrate eldest sons. In this manner, Watanabe was credited with bringing in great quantities of gold, gemstones, and artworks. In China, he had headed one of the special service agencies, or Tokumu Kikan, whose duties were espionage, counter-espionage, propaganda, and fifth column subversion. Watanabe was then given the job of terrorizing Malaysia's overseas Chinese. His techniques are well known from speeches he made and papers he drafted. Quote, "The Chinese are prone to maintain a false obedience, and they are as crafty as anything and hard to control. They ought to be dealt with unsparingly," unquote. To help, he enlisted cronies from his days in Manchuria. One was his old friend Colonel Tsuji Masanobu, a flamboyant leader of the Total War cult who would help plan the strike south and the Malaya campaign of General Yamashita. Another was Takashi Toru, who had served in China as an intelligence officer with Special Service Section 8 and was an expert in, quote, "the Chinese problem," unquote. The Nazis, of course, referred to the Jews as the Jewish problem, unquote, its final solution being the Holocaust. And again, a very similar conceptualization of the Chinese took place in Asia, not only by the Japanese, but for the purposes of present discussion, most importantly, from the Muslim majorities in some of the Muslim majority countries that were occupied by Japan. Continuing, Watanabe described Takashi as, quote, "a complicated character, conceited, quarrelsome, and aggressive, but his ruthlessness was exactly what was needed." Colonel Tsuji was Japan's most ruthless special service agent, combining traits that made Goebbels, Heydrich, and Skorzeny uniquely feared of the Nazi Party. Prior to the strike south, Imperial General Headquarters issued to officers a handbook written by Tsuji, which makes repeated references to plundering the wealth of, quote, "the treasure houses of the Far East," unquote. The methods he recommended were based on terror. Compassion and sympathy were to be avoided. No longer could the overseas Chinese, quote, "indulge themselves in a hedonistic and wasteful way of life," unquote. Japan would force them, quote, "to account for their past mistakes and to make them ready to give up their lives and property," unquote. Tsuji got everyone's attention with a horrific atrocity. By noon on February 21, 1942, all male Chinese on the island of Singapore between 18 and 50 were assembled in five locations. Each walked past a row of hooded informers. When a hood nodded, that Chinese was condemned to death, his skin stamped with a triangular ink chop. Others were stamped with squares and released. By the way, compare this with the wearing of the gold star to which the Jews were subjected, and ultimately the tattooing of numbers on their wrists when they went to concentration camps. Continuing with the Seagraves account, others were stamped with squares and released. A total of 70,699 Singapore Chinese were taken off for torture and killing. Mass executions lasted many days with Tsuji watching closely. Most were shot, bayoneted, or beheaded, but 20,000 were roped together on barges and taken into the sea lanes off Singapore, where they were forced overboard. Those who did not drown quickly were machine-gunned. This nightmare was called Suk Ching, or ethnic cleansing. Tsuji then extended the Suk Ching to the whole Malay Peninsula, where another 40,000 were slain, including women, school children, and babies. Similar mass executions of ethnic Chinese happened elsewhere. Colonel Watanabe declared that Singapore Chinese must atone to Emperor Hirohito to the sum of 50 million yen as a gift on the emperor's birthday in April. This was to equal to one-fourth of the total currency in circulation in Malaya at the time. Takashi was to collect the contributions. Since nobody could produce that much cash on short notice, Takase arranged a loan of 22 million yen from the Yokohama Specie Bank, so the birthday present did not fall short. Chinese were required to repay the loan and interest with gold bullion, hard foreign currency, or other tangible assets. While Sumatra had its Royal Dutch Shell oil fields, Malaya was the greatest rubber-producing region in the world. Using scrip, Watanabe brought up all rubber stocks for bought up all rubber stocks for shipment to Japan. He then ordered all rubber estates and processing facilities sold to Japan's Zaibatsu conglomerates, again for scrip. And of course, as we've seen in numerous broadcasts, including For the Record 426 and some of the other discussions of the Seagrave Gold Warrior text, those Zaibatsu, those family trusts, were in turn cartel partners with many of the most important American corporations who had the same sort of capital relationship with the Japanese corporations, the Zaibatsu, as they did with the German corporations in Nazi Germany. And so again, bear in mind as you contemplate the position of the overseas or outside Chinese that Haji Amin al-Husseini did broadcasts for the Japanese on behalf of the Japanese, and railed against the ethnic or overseas Chinese, the Jews of Asia, and was doing so in order to effectively propagandize and mobilize the support of the Muslim majorities for the Japanese occupiers. There is it should be funny, but it's actually a grim supplement, I guess, to the story of the outside Chinese and the mobilization of scapegoating. The Rents.com website, that is the website of an internet radio fellow named Jeff Rents, who is sort of a conspiracy maven whose work is particularly open to right-wing and explicitly fascist conspiracy theories. The Rents website carried the following article from the Malaysian National News Service of June 12th of 2006. Group seeks Dr. Mahathir's assistance to reopen 9/11 investigation. It's Dateline Putrajaya, Bernama. Putrajaya, a group of concerned Americans and their sympathizers had sought the support of former Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad in their effort to push for an international investigation of the September 11, 2001 tragedy. Representatives of the group, including a survivor of the attacks, were on the World Trade Center in New York, met Dr. Mahathir here Monday with a claim that the official version of what transpired on that day was far from the truth. We want him, Dr. Mahathir, who is chairman of Perdana Global Peace Organization, to help set up an international commission to reopen the investigation, unquote, said Jimmy Walter, who has brought together individuals under the Reopen 9/11 organization dedicated to opening a real investigation into the tragic attacks. Joining him today were American Free Press journalist Michael Collins Piper, Yvonne Ridley, who is the political editor of Islam Channel United Kingdom, and William Rodriguez, the last man to run out of the World Trade Center before it collapsed. Note Michael Collins Piper. He is a journalist first with he used to write for the neo-Nazi Liberty Lobby, the neo-Nazi Spotlight. He now writes for the American Free Press. That is the supplemental fascist publication of the Willis Carto interest. Basically, for all intents and purposes, the guy is a Nazi. Published a book blaming the assassination of President Kennedy on, three guesses, the Jews. It is interesting to see how relatively smoothly people like Michael Collins Piper, basically for all intents and purposes an outright Nazi, have been able to move into the so-called 9/11 truth movement. And here we have them catering to Dr. Mahathir. Too bad the Grand Mufti isn't around. He probably would have been right in there with the whole crew. That concludes For the Record program number 580, The Jews of Asia, the Sukching Massacres and their Significance for Today. This has been recorded on January 15th of the year 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.